I don't.
Can you stay reasonably close? I think I can manage above a whisper, but I'm going to be pretty soft today. I'm still trying to spare my voice because it's not in very good shape. And I've got two glasses of tea, which is about perfectly fine if you can, if that works. Okay. Do you need a plug?
Yeah, but I think I'm
good. All right, I don't think I'm going to try to review, except to the extent that you have any questions on what we did last week. So let me start with whether you have questions and then go on to talk about criminal law. So on the tort law stuff, any questions? Any thoughts on the puzzle that we're going to be discussing a little bit later, which is why we have both tort law and criminal law? All right, in a very general sense, they're doing the same work, all right? I commit a wrong, injuring you, either you call the cops or a lawyer, something bad happens to me, that's a reason not to commit wrongs. And the tort mechanism uses I'm going to be speaking very softly, so you're going to be close. The tort mechanism uses the victim as the person controlling it, the criminal as the state. Some offenses can be prosecuted either way, as which has been discovered. So any thoughts on why we have both?
It seems to me like criminal law is there as a process to ensure protections against the deprivation of liberty. If you're going to deprive someone of their ability to function a little bit, put them in jail.
So you're saying that we need an entirely different mechanism if the penalty is imprisonment or execution than if the penalty is a fine, but criminal law includes many things punished by fines. And as it happens, if you go back a few hundred years, there was in fact a civil action called the appeal of felony, which could result in execution. Blackstone mentions it, although it was pretty much a dead letter by the time he was writing in the 18th century. So that's one answer, that one set of penalties requires a different mechanism. Other guesses? While you're thinking about this, the other question, because I think it's a set of related questions that all people dealing with law should think about and mostly don't, is why the laws differ in the way they do. Why do you have different standards of proof, intent versus non-intent, and so forth. But anyway, let's go on to this. This is just a rough sketch of what I'm going to be doing. I'm not going to try reading PowerPoints today, given my voice. So, people don't usually think of it that way. The oddity of the system is the idea that I am not the victim of a crime. That no private individual has ever been the victim of a crime in the United States, legally speaking. Right? Only a tort. All crimes are committed against the state.
Sometimes there really is no victim, right? Speeding tickets and things of sort, there are infractions. Not one individual can be deemed the victim. There are other
parts where. But some torts have dispersed victims as well. That's what you have class actions for, and you could think of a speeding that the victim is all the other people driving on the highway.
There's a difficulty in class actions with identifying the class of people, and having a state actor engage a lot of that difficulty is more efficient for certain acts.
Might be. Maybe then all of our class action cases should be turned into. But you could also, if you think about speeding, if the road were privately owned, speeding could then be a contract violation with the owner. And if you think of the state as a owner of highways, in the same way that the state, after all, can have tort actions if you damage state property and such. and you could imagine a system where speeding tickets were tort or breach of contract actions by the state acting as the owner of the road, where the condition of your using the road was agreeing to abide by the speed limit. So I'm not sure that's a very good example. There may be others that are better.
In the case of murdering someone who has no family, there is no victim.
The
victim
sure, there's a victim. He's just dead.
Dead.
There's a tort. There's a tort of wrongful loss of life.
Right, who's going to bring the tort?
That is, under existing law, anybody who is injured by his death. But I would argue that the proper way of handling that in tort law would be that he has a claim for the value of his life that has been lost, and that that claim is a part of his estate, and that whoever inherits his estate can then sue on that claim. And you could imagine, if people were seriously concerned about it, that you could contract with a private firm and say, look, I'll give you or I'll sell to you the right to sue if I am killed, in order that other people will have an incentive to sue if I, in order there'll be somebody with an incentive to sue if I'm killed, in order that people won't kill me. And of course, very few crimes. Murder is a quite unusual crime, after all. Very small fraction of all, even felonies, are murders. So in most cases, there is a victim in this ordinary sense. And as I say, there are torts for which exactly the same thing is true, where the tort has resulted in the death of the supposed plaintiff. So let's go on to this point where you probably, assuming you have read the chapters, I hope you have, you already know the answer to the puzzle, but it's still, I think, an interesting question, which is, from the economist's rather bizarre standpoint, where we count benefits to everybody, including criminals, what's wrong with theft? And here is my answer, at least. Again, I'm not going to read it aloud. I think that's too much. Do people follow the argument, or do they have see problems with it?
Spend resources trying to prevent it.
Yeah. What about that?
I mean, it's a loss.
That's dead weight loss, right?
It's a loss expense.
Right. That's my example of keeping my money in my shoe. That's intended as an implausible but memorable example of such a thing. Questions? Does it make sense? Does it not make sense? The general form of the argument, it turns out to apply to a lot of things other than theft for this one case. And I think I've discussed it briefly earlier, the question of rent-seeking. Did I discuss Ann Kruger's article that actually coined the term the political economy of the rent-seeking society, where she was looking at basically spending money getting exchange permits, which were worth a lot of money in poor countries. We discussed homesteading, I think. But litigation is another important case that you, in a sense, are going to make your living employed to do rent-seeking, at least those of you who are in tort law, as plaintiffs or defendants' attorneys. Notice that rent-seeking is not a moral category, because from the standpoint of the economics, the lock on my door is rent-seeking just as much as the burglar's tools are. We're both spending resources in order to make sure that an existing asset is in our hands instead of somebody else's. All right? The terminology is just because I find it useful to be able to distinguish between the category that I'm calling a crime and one occurrence of that category, which is I'm calling an offense. And I'm suggesting that we would expect offenses to be inefficient in the economist's sense, for the basic argument that I'm describing there, that the typical offense is substituting for a voluntary transaction like buying a car or paying you to let me trespass on your property or whatever. And as long as the transaction costs aren't too high, you would expect that the transaction would occur without the offense if you weren't able to commit the offense. All right? And this is going back to the point I made a long time ago about property rules versus liability rules, that you have a property rule, and if the violation of a property rule that typically is a crime, because the lowest cost way of moving resources to their highest valued use is via a market transaction, and therefore the transactions that won't happen there but will happen via stealing are the ones where moving to a lower valued use, namely from the person who values it more who owns it to the person who values it less who steals it. So therefore there is some presumption that offenses are inefficient and that we'd like to get rid of all of them, but it's only a presumption. And consider my examples of efficient crimes. So then the question is, how does the legal system let the efficient crimes, so to speak, occur, or the actions that appear to be crimes, that, like my example, while at the same time not letting the ordinary ones, which where the cost is larger than the benefit, occur? So what are the mechanisms the legal system can use to get that result?
Defenses.
The legal system. What do you mean by defenses?
Like the necessity defenses.
Ah, yes. So one, very good, I was thinking of defenses like locks on my door, not being a lawyer. Right. So one answer is what I think of as special casing it, to say, if you can show us this is an official offense, then it's not a crime anymore. And that's what the defense of necessity for the locked cabin would be, maybe the other one as well. What about the case where there isn't an easy way for an external observer to know that the benefit is larger than the cost? All right, so suppose I was speeding not because my wife was giving birth in the back seat, but because there was an absolutely vital meeting and I had been delayed, and if I didn't get to that meeting, a project would fall through that was going to produce benefits of millions of dollars. So when I say that to the traffic cop, he says, yeah, tell me another one. All right, so how can one have a legal system where that kind of speeding will occur and ordinary speeding won't?
How we could have a system where that does happen, or what happens now, because now you get a ticket.
And does the ticket prevent you from driving fast when you've got a multi-million dollar meeting?
So it seems like you would, like the ticket would have to be worth millions of dollars.
In order to prevent him, but do we want to prevent him?
I think that you want to have some incentive to ensure that people act responsibly. So instead of, I mean, he could have allowed himself time, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, there are always circumstances, but you don't.
But if the situation is one where speeding is worth much more to him than the cost and additional risk it imposes on others, then doesn't the economic argument imply that we would like to have arrangements where he will speed under those circumstances? We aren't deducing crimes from moral considerations. We're trying to deduce, as it were, the criminal law from what rules would be economically efficient. After all, the man whose wife was giving birth in the back seat may also have been irresponsible. He should have brought her to the hospital, 12 hours earlier.
I think the problem is that it's not observable.
It's not observable to whom?
Not observable to the police officer.
That's right.
Or the judicial system
that's
imposing
right.
the punishment.
Who is it observable to?
The person. It's basically a, I can't remember the word for it.
But subjective.
Yeah. In other words, I think the argument would be reasonably make that in cases
where we're looking at internalized costs to the actor, that would be inefficient to design a legal system where there's wholesale internal exceptions to the rule.
Well,
not wholesale.
What I want to claim is that we have one already. That you already pointed out that we have one, only you had it backwards. You said we would need $1 million ticket to stop him, to which my reply is, since we only have $100 ticket, we don't stop him. And that's the right outcome. How do you get people to use their internal information? You make them bear the costs, and then let them decide whether the benefits are larger than the costs. Aren't we back where we've been over and over again about how you get decentralized coordination, which you do by having the individual who's making the choice bear both the costs and the benefits? In Prince, the argument so far says, we're going to get further later, but at this point the argument says that the ticket should measure the external cost he imposes on everybody else by driving fast, and then we decide whether he's willing to pay it or not, just as in principle with an affluent fee, with a Pigouvian tax, we would say that the that the fee for dumping a ton of sulfur dioxide in the air is an attempt to measure the damage done. Now, there is a further complication in the case of criminal law, which is that in many cases we catch offenders with a probability much less than one. So, if the damage done by my speeding is $100, and the fine is $100, but I only have one chance in 100 of being caught, what, in effect, is the cost to me of speeding? $1. If I have a $100 fine with a chance of 1 in 100... Right. So it's only one. That's way too low. So the first half is your defense of necessity exactly, and the second half is that if we set the probability times the fine equal to the damage done, then the individual offender gets to choose. Now, I'm ignoring the fact that the offender might be risk-averse or risk-preferring, because that's a complication that one can deal with, but I don't think it's worth going into here. But for a moment, let's assume most of the time in our discussion today that everybody's risk-neutral, and take it on faith that we've got ways of building in risk preferences if we have to. All right?
Value of the chance that they're going to get caught times the punishment.
And if this theory is right, what is the value of the probability times the punishment? What are we supposed to be setting it equal to in a Bagoovian tax?
The value of the life of the person you value.
The value of the life, the damage done, right? So therefore, if this metal is right, then all the murders that occur are efficient murders, where the world is on net better off because the value to the murderer of killing somebody is greater than the value of the life of the person who was murdered. Isn't that what follows from just following out the logic? Do you think that is? Do you think it is likely that that is a correct description of the actual situation? So then the interesting question is, can we save economic theory? That's one answer, is people are irrational, or one answer could be. Possible answers are, we don't really believe in maximizing economic efficiency in cases like this, and therefore we don't do it that way. But of course, if that's right, that suggests we should have even more severe punishments, right? And a different answer is people are irrational. But I want to ask whether you can, in fact, save the theory by just doing it better. Whether, in fact, I've made a mistake in my analysis, which I claim I have, or an omission of my analysis, which is important, such that it is at least possible that the present system is economically efficient, even if everybody is rational.
What if I don't understand? It doesn't seem that the punishment can ever be equal to.
I'm not sure that's true. We could try very hard to catch people, and then we could torture them for a year before they died. We could catch people and execute their entire family. There have been societies that did that. I think if you think about these, you may get led to, in the direction I want you to go, as to what I've left out in this whole analysis. Of course, you might. You don't have to limit it to murder. Murder is the most striking case. But do you believe that all burglaries are efficient burglaries? Do you believe that those burglaries which do occur, occur because the property is worth more dollars to the burglar than it is to the owner?
I can give you a personal example where that's absolutely false. The person who took my laptop, the laptop had personal data on it. They made that particular device.
Yeah. It's clearly not true. The question is, if we're willing to assume for the moment that we have an economically efficient set of laws, which maybe we shouldn't, what if I left out of my analysis of optimal punishment that might explain why inefficient offenses occur, or to put it differently, why it is efficient that inefficient offenses occur, which sounds paradoxical.
Information. It's my closest critique of Bagoo that you aren't accounting for both sides.
I'm thinking not so much of both sides. The fact that imposing this Bagoovian tax is not free. And that, consider my example there, that gets back to your point about what you'd have to do in order to make the punishment for murder sufficiently large. You would have to do things that, for other reasons, we have strong reasons not to want to do, like killing the family, for example. So consider my it's an inefficient offense, but it's also inefficient to deter that offense. See? Implicitly, when we call it an inefficient offense, we're imagining that we could prevent it at no cost, in which case it's worth doing. Who is the only person who can prevent the offense at no cost under most circumstances? The offender. So therefore, one way of putting it is that when we say that burglary was inefficient, we mean if the burglar was trying to maximize total welfare of the society, he wouldn't have committed it. But of course he isn't. But it might be efficient in the sense it might cost more for us to keep it from happening than the net damage it does. What's the net damage done by stealing your laptop?
Well,
principle, not how many dollars.
The difference between the guy with a laptop and me and the guy with a person.
Very good, right. And so, if that difference is very large, we're willing to go to a good deal of trouble even for stealing laptops. If it's still positive, it's still an inefficient crime, but not very large, then it might be that deterring it is more costly than having it happen.
So in the event that deterring this particular crime would have cost $200, it becomes inefficient like that.
Inefficient to deter it. Even though it's still an inefficient crime. You'd rather it didn't occur, but not at that price. Just as there's a company that's actually making fully electric automobiles at the moment, and they've got a new one which isn't out yet, but it's going to be an actual sedan. It sounds moderately practical, but very expensive. The one they've got out is like $100,000 at the moment. And suppose you say to me, do you want that car? And the natural answer would be, yeah, it sounds really neat. And the economist says, well, then, why have you put in an order for it? And the answer is, I want the car, but not net of the cost of getting it. I want to deter the theft of your laptop, but I may not want it net of the cost of deterring it. Suppose you were thinking about cost of deterrence. What does it mean to talk about the cost of deterring one more offense? What would we have to do? Suppose we've got a legal system, we have some fine, we have a certain number of policemen looking for people, and 10,000 burglaries a year happen. What would we have to do to reduce it to 9,999? What are some of the ways we might do that? One way would be to increase the probability of being caught by spending more on resources, with the result that the probability of being caught was a little higher. What's the other obvious thing you could do?
Increase
punishment, right. There are some other possibilities. You could lower standards of proof, say, but let's just take those two. It's clear that hiring an extra cop is costly. How about, yeah?
Sorry, I was going to ask, are we going to talk later about, like, maybe, like the fact that the thief, because we're assuming rational, but something like the thief doesn't correctly value the punisher.
I'm going to be, I think, trying to understand the effects of irrationality is certainly an interesting and useful project, but it's not really a project for this course.
Well,
it's hard enough with rational people.
Well, not necessarily. I'm not really even saying it's.
What do you mean then by not correctly valued?
So what I mean is that either, like, it is irrational that a thief wouldn't correctly assess the punishment, because I think that would explain a lot of inefficient offenses.
One of the assumptions, incidentally, that we're going to be making through this discussion, but that's one of the things I think I discuss at the end of the book you really ought to drop if you wanted to do everything right, is the probabilities are the same for all thieves.
Right.
Because it might easily be that there are some people who correctly believe that they're very good thieves, or who correctly believe that this particular opportunity is a really good opportunity to steal with nobody watching. That would complicate it.
That's more what I was getting at. No. That there are rational reasons for misestimating.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I'm not sure that would be a misestimate. It might be correct. Yes. But
like this theory of rationality, it assumes that everybody values everything the same way.
What do you mean? Okay. On the contrary, his value for the laptop is much higher than the thieves.
But it assumes that the thief would value it the same way too. Okay, so if I kill someone, like, and the punishment is that you're going to kill my entire family, then that assumes that I value the life of each one of the members of my family. Let's say someone only has one other person with their family.
We kill that person and we torture him, and we torture the murderer for a year before killing him. In principle, but this is getting to, I think, the relevant point, which is you can see it's easy to see what the cost is of raising the probability. What's the cost of raising the punishment?
More time in prison, more prison guards.
If One cost is if you're using imprisonment, the cost is the cost only the cost of the of paying for the prison. What's the other cost of imprisoning people?
The best people to be productive in society. No.
What I'm objecting to is the idea that your value, that the value of your life is mainly to other people. How about the fact that you don't want to spend a year in prison? All right, because after all, to the extent you're a productive member of society, you're getting paid for it. To the extent you're sitting in prison twiddling your thumbs instead of earning money or having fun or doing whatever you wanted to do, that's a net cost to you. Right? Remember, criminals count too. So think about the difference between a fine and imprisonment. A fine, the only cost is the mechanics of collecting it. Imprisonment, so you would think it's sort of that the idealized fine has zero punishment cost. You lose $100, the state collects $100. Right? The idealized imprisonment has a punishment cost with more than 100% of the punishment. Because you lose a year of freedom. That's the punishment. That's why you don't want it. That's why it's going to start to deter you. And in addition to that, the rest of us has to pay for the prison. Right? So therefore, the cost per unit of punishment, as it were, is zero, ideally, for a fine, and is more than 100% for imprisonment. Now, this raises an interesting question, which we'll be getting to later. Can you think of other criminal punishments which, in terms of their efficiency, of cost per unit of deterrence, are worse than fines, but better than imprisonment?
Just like work crews?
A work crew would be one possibility. Penal slavery, which of course historically has been one form of punishment. Galley slavery, for example, is an example historically. That's one possibility we're thinking about. What about one we actually impose? Note that the cost of imprisonment is more than 100%. It's more than what the criminal loses. Well, what are the obvious forms of punishment which can be arranged so that the cost of the punishment consists almost entirely of it?
Parole. Or like a partial
thing. You people are all much too hindered. You kill people. Execution. Assuming that you're really willing to do it and therefore you don't have extended legal things. The only serious cost to execution is the life of the guy who's executed.
There's stigma attached to being convicted.
Stigma is a very interesting case because I'm going to argue later that stigma may be an even more efficient punishment than a fine. Because stigma consists of information other people have about you, which affects how they interact with you. And to the extent that it's true information, they are likely to gain more than you lose by using that information, in which case it's actually got a negative punishment cost. That's, you're getting ahead of me, but stigma is sort of a very interesting case for that reason. All right. But in any case, the point I'm making here is that it looks at first as though raising expected punishment is going to be costly either because it requires shifting for some criminals from fines to imprisonment, and it costs more to get your deterrence via imprisonment, or because it involves lengthening the imprisonment, or because if we keep the punishments constant, we have to catch more people, which requires more cops. And, of course, if we catch more people and punish them the same as before, then our punishment costs are going to be higher if some of the punishment is imprisonment only, or jail. But the question for a moment, we're asking, what is the cost of deterring one more offense? And so far, all of our discussion makes it sound as though that cost is positive. Let me leave out stigma as a special case. I want to claim that, in fact, it's entirely possible that the cost of deterring an offense could be negative. How do I get that?
Taking
any privileges? No. Exactly in the framework we're working, one of the things we've forgotten about is that if you deter an offense, you don't have to catch the criminal. So if you imagine an offense where when you make the punishment a little more severe, the number of offenses drops a lot, you're imposing 10% more time in jail on half as many people, So that's actually cheaper. So if you really think about it, the extra cost of deterring an offense is going to be positive if it's hard to deter offenses, if you have to increase the punishment a lot to deter them a little. But it's going to be negative if it's easy to deter offenses, because now you make more out of not having to catch and punish people because they didn't commit crimes than you lose the other way.
So it's like chopping off somebody's hand if they steal.
Suppose it were the case that with that punishment nobody would ever steal. It'd be a very cheap punishment. I should say, just in the interest of historical accuracy, as far as I can tell, that is a very uncommon punishment in Islamic law. That what's going on with Sharia, with Islamic law, is that you have a few legal rules that are in the Quran, of which that's one of them. And from the standpoint of Muslim jurists, they can't change those. In general, one of the doctrines of Islamic law is separation of state and law. Just like we separate state and church, that the law is deduced by legal scholars from religious sources rather than handed down by the state. And that's a considerable oversimplification. But the one result is that when you have a Quranic rule that people don't like, they find ways of making it less and less likely to happen. So that, for instance, it is not what's called a hot offense, the Quranic offense, to steal if you're starving. That means, as I understand it in normal Islamic law, that you cannot get that punishment for stealing food. It is assumed that if you stole food, it was because you were starving. And my understanding, at least, is that in at least many Islamic legal systems, there are a whole bunch of other outs, with the result that although technically you have to do that, in fact, you usually don't. But that's another interesting legal issue, because it's sort of like the issue in a constitutional system. If the Constitution says you can't do X, but you want to do X. So then I guess the equivalent of that in our system would be things like the 50-mile-per-hour speed limit. The Constitution gives Congress no authority at all over speed limits within the states. But, as it's interpreted, it does let the federal government give money to the states. And if it gives money to the states, you can set conditions on giving that money and so forth. So that's sort of another example of the interesting phenomenon that you've got these fixed points in the law and people who don't like them and how you work around them. That's not the subject today, but I just thought it was an interesting point. So this is the sort of formal discussion of what I was just saying. I've decided it may work better for conversation if I discuss things and then show the slide instead of the other way around. Remember your sort of formal economics. When you're analyzing the firm can produce automobiles in many different ways with different combinations of labor, capital, raw materials, and such. And you can conceptually imagine that the firm says, if we want to produce 1 million automobiles, what are all the different ways we could do it? Price each of those ways. Find the least expensive bundle of inputs that will produce 1 million automobiles. That's the cost to us of producing 1 million automobiles. Repeat for 1,100,000. Repeat for 1,000,000. We now have what we call the total cost curve, which shows the cost to us of producing any given quantity of automobiles in the least expensive way. And what I am claiming is that what I am doing is duplicating that, where what you're producing is deterrence, that the inputs are probability and punishment. You say for a given level of deterrence, what are all of the different combinations of probability and punishment that would give me that level of deterrence, meaning that are equivalent to the criminal. Pick the one that's least costly. Repeat for all levels of deterrence. We now have a total cost curve for deterrence. All right? It might turn out that in some cases the total cost of a lot of deterrence was lower than of a little deterrence, because with a lot of deterrence there aren't very many offenses to catch. So, it's an interesting case where the analytical apparatus developed for ordinary economics turns out to apply in a perfectly relatively straightforward way to the application of economics to the law. Questions on what's on this slide? So now what we want is to figure out, for a given crime, what the optimal level of expected punishment is. And the rule, as in lots of other cases, is if making expected punishment a little higher saves more than it costs, you do it. And you therefore keep doing it until the last little increase in expected punishment costs just as much as it's worth. So what does that mean? It means until the marginal cost of deterrence is just equal to the net damage of the offense that's deterred. And the trick here is, what's the net damage? It's the damage to the victim minus the gain to the criminal. Assume we know the damage to the victim. Maybe we don't always, but suppose we do. How do we know the gain to the criminal? And the answer is, that's easy. For the marginal offense, the gain to the criminal is exactly equal to the expected punishment. That's why it's the marginal offense, right? The marginal offense is the one that gets deterred if you raise punishment a tiny bit, or gets permitted if you lower it a tiny bit. The one just on the margin of committing. Why? Because the benefit for him for that offense is just about equal to the expected punishment. All right? So therefore, if you actually run through the mathematics, which I think I do in the book, I don't remember if I do here or not, you actually can get a formula giving you what the optimal punishment is. So here is the in verbal form what I went through a minute ago. So the reason that murders occur, on this analysis at least, is not that they're efficient murders. It's that they're inefficient murders, but that the cost of deterring one more murder would be at least as much as the net damage done by that murder.
If someone is in prison, then they can't commit another offense. So there's
yes.
Cost to deter.
Right. This just demonstrates the virtue of reading PowerPoint slides, even when I don't. Let me go back, because I'm pretty sure I got that. Here we are. I will assume. Perfectly right that a more complete analysis, we would say, perhaps imprisonment isn't so costly as it seems after all, because it has the indirect benefit of keeping them someplace where they can only commit crimes against other prisoners. But again, in order to get the analysis down to a level where we can think it through clearly, I've been leaving out both the possibility of incapacitation and the possibility of rehabilitation. And if you wanted to include incapacitation, you would want to include it in your punishment cost calculation by saying that, it may have to get a little complicated, but basically to the extent that having him in prison saves us some net costs of crimes he would have committed otherwise, and saves us the cost of catching when he commits them and of punishing when he commits them, that would be an additional benefit which might reduce the cost. But I did, in fact, cover it just very, very briefly because... So therefore, for the easily deterred one, I don't know if you're familiar, those two greater signs are a symbolism for expected value, which is probability times amount. All right. So therefore, oops, this should be more. Sorry, I've got a mistake here. All right, so. Unless I am mistaken, if you read other people's books on law any kind, you probably won't get this, because at least, maybe it's changed now, but at least it used to be that the standard approach was straight to Goofian approach. And part of the reason I've gone into so much detail is that I think that was a mistake that was sort of very widespread in the field, and that my point that we have inefficient murders is a simple way of seeing why it's unlikely that that's the right description. So this is the point I was making earlier, but read it again. Assume the punishment costs are low because it's a fine, but if there are sizable costs to detecting and to people trying to evade detection and such, you might have to include those too. All right, let's now go on to your case of stigma, because that's actually an interesting one. Do people follow the point that I'm making here? That if it's really true that the loss to you through not being able to be hired as a treasurer is bigger than the loss to them firing a possible embezzler, then you should be willing to offer to work for a low enough wage at which you'd still get some benefit of being hired, and you'd be more than compensating them for the risk. If you can't, that's some evidence that hiring you hurts them more than it helps you. And if that's the case, then knowing you're somebody they shouldn't hire produces that benefit. So that's the sense in which stigma could have negative punishment cost. All right? Clear? Good. All right, let's go back to one of the central points, which I think I discussed briefly before, but I want to go over again, because it's one of the things that, in a sense, a lot of people find weird about economic analysis. Of law, and I find rather elegant about the economic analysis of law. So suppose it turns out that when we finished our project, we've recreated the more or less the moral code of our society. What might that mean? I say might, because I don't think there is a clear answer, but at the same time, it seems to be an extraordinarily interesting fact if it were true. I'm not sure if it is. Where does morality come from? Maybe. That would be what that would suggest. Best for society in a rather narrow sense of economic efficiency, you know. So how would that happen? Why would you have this gut level feeling stealing is wrong? Why would that follow from economics you had never read when you were a 12-year-old and knew that stealing was wrong? Yes. What?
If it provides no benefit.
If it provides no benefit? I don't understand. Why do you have moral beliefs? Where do they come from? And if it's true, why do they correspond to the rules of behavior that maximize economic efficiency, which is pure, I'm not claiming it's true, but suppose it turned out to be true. I'm only saying it would be interesting if it did. Anybody? Trying in part to show why I think it's much better to do it this way than the other way. And this is not everybody agrees. I mean, there's an old piece, I think, by my friend Gordon Tully, who argues that you shouldn't count the welfare of the criminal. But I think he's wrong. But I will leave you to think about where morality comes from, which it seems to me is one of the intriguing questions that human beings ought to think about, since you may, after all, have opportunities to make money by stealing from people, and if you're going to turn them down, you should think about why you turn them down. And you may be counting on other people not stealing from you, and you'd like to think about why. All right, this gets us back to our earlier point. And the first half of this is the answer that I gave when I was first teaching this material 30-some years ago, I suppose. And my students kept objecting on, I think, moral intuitions, that it was wrong to let rich people commit crimes just because they could pay for them. And I kept saying, well, it's economically efficient to do it. And eventually I stopped talking and started listening long enough to think about whether maybe I was wrong. And the analysis I've just given you of optimal punishment actually came out of that experience. And I started out thinking about this question, and that got me into thinking about how you ought to incorporate the cost of deterrence into optimal deterrence. Because, as I say, if you do the economics right, and if you drop the zero enforcement cost assumption, now one difference between, from the economist standpoint, what's the relevant difference between Bill Gates and me that this first point is demonstrating? That's what it may be coming from. But what I would have said the relevant difference is the cost of deterring him, or putting it differently, the supply curve for offenses, given that we're paying or charging, maybe demand curve, you can call it either one, a certain amount, at a given price, he'll buy more speeding than I will. All right. So therefore, he has a different supply curve for offenses, but since I've just shown that the optimal punishment depends on how offenses vary with deterrence, therefore the optimal punishment might well be different from Gates than for me. By the way, there is one country in the world which actually works on the principle of speeding fines being a proportion of income rather than a fixed amount. You know which country it is? Finland. One of the stranger and more interesting places in the world. But there was some news story a few years ago that I think like the president of Nokia or something had gotten a $90,000 speeding ticket, such number.
Is it fair at all to consider the value of a dollar? Because to Bill Gates, his value of a dollar is much, much different. And so to get the same level of deterrence from Bill Gates, you'd soon have to charge him a lot more dollars to get.
But then the question is the conclusion, therefore, that his speeding is efficient because it's worth lots of dollars to him? Or is the conclusion that you charge him more? But I want to push a little further, because suppose what we were punishing him for was not speeding but stealing money. Would the argument still apply? Is the punishment necessary to deter Bill Gates for stealing $1,000 any more than the punishment necessary to deter me from stealing $1,000? It isn't, right? Because the dollars he steals are worth less to him, too. So that suggests the following. Think of the two kinds of offenses. Actually sort of grind the machinery, as it were, and I've got an old published article which does this. It turns out that for some shapes of the curves, the right answer is that you charge Bill Gates a higher fine or higher punishment on the grounds that you need to deter him. But for other shapes of it, the right answer is you don't punish him at all, or you charge him a lower punishment because the cost for deterring him is so high that it's not worth doing it.
Wait, if we design a curve based on total population, isn't Bill Gates part of the total population?
But we could do price discrimination. We could do what the Finns do and say, instead of having, well, that's the analysis so far says, all right, exactly what you're saying. Here's the whole population. As we increase the punishment, how does the number of murders or whatever go down? But you could imagine saying, let's do better than that. Let's go back to the question of crimes of passion. Suppose you believe, and I'm skeptical about it, suppose you believe that crimes of passion are utterly undeterrable. No point in punishing them. why waste valuable prison space on someone who's never going to commit a crime again? Or at least it's just as likely you're in prison if you don't. So similarly, you could imagine saying, let's price discriminate among offenders. Suppose it were the case that a $100 fine will almost always deter me from speeding. A $1,000 fine will almost always deter Bill Gates from speeding. And speeding does damage of $2,000. Well, you could impose a $1,000 fine on both of us, but I often can't pay that enough to be in jail. $100 fine on me, $1,000 fine on Gates, no speeding. Right? So you could imagine a system, and maybe to some extent you have, I don't know, where one of the things you tailor, I think you do have, one of the things you tailor the punishment by is what you believe about the supply curve of the offender. All right? Just as if you think about price discrimination when you're selling things, one of the things you tailor the price you charge different customers is what you believe their demand curve is. All right, the price discrimination by a seller, you're trying to get people to pay the highest price you can, each of them will pay. Price discrimination here, you're trying to use the lowest punishment that will deter each of them.
So, in that case, you would try to be encouraging Bill Gates to speed as much as possible?
No. If you were sure that his speeding was inefficient, then you would probably have a higher punishment for him than for us. Because the higher punishment was needed to deter him. Fines are a low-cost punishment anyway, but we won't be able to pay the fine that will deter him. If you think that his speeding is always efficient, take the opposite extreme, in principle, the efficient thing to do is you let him speed, and you only punish the people speeding is sometimes efficient. If you think his speeding is sometimes efficient, then you might want to have a punishment equal to the damage done, so he'll only do it when it's efficient. Now, obviously, the more complicated the system gets, the more information you need that you don't have to run it. So most of our analysis, we do lump everybody together, the way you were saying, but it's worth thinking about, whether you have to. There's actually, I have an ex-student called John Lott from a long time ago, who's famous mostly for some stuff he did a long time ago, arguing that laws permitting concealed carry of handguns reduce certain kinds of crime. And that was very controversial for obvious reasons. But John, in general, writes controversial articles. He's a very bright guy. I'm not sure he's always right. But I think his most politically incorrect article, I think, that he ever wrote was one in which he argued that in our legal system, in fact, rich people get on average less criminal punishment than poor people because they have better lawyers, basically. And that this was evidence that our legal system was efficient because the social cost of locking up rich people is higher than poor people because their time is worth more dollars per day. He ignored this line of argument, which he shouldn't have because he had seen it, and essentially was doing the straight Bagouvian version. But to argue that we let rich people off lightly and it's a good thing is sort of designed to make people dislike you, which John likes doing, I think, judging by his record in the past. Anyway, he's an interesting guy, a little bit crazy like most interesting people. All right, let me now get back to a question that I was hitting at before. Do any of you know, why not hang them all as part of the title of one of my articles in which I explored this, do any of you recognize the supposed historical quote that I'm playing off of here? It's probably not true. Any of you ever heard of the Albigensian Crusade? The Albigensians were a heretical Christian sect in southern France in, I would guess, about the 13th century or so, somewhere back there in the Middle Ages. And there was a crusade against them, led by northern French nobles, authorized by the Pope, basically. And the story, which probably isn't true, is that at one point one of the southern cities had been captured by the crusaders, and the commander of the crusader turns to the papal legate and says, how will we know which of the people in the city are heretical Albigensians who we should kill, and which are good Catholics who just happen to live in the city? And the legate's reply was, kill them all, God will know his own. which is a great classic line, even though, as I say, there's any much historical evidence that he really said it. So anyway, why not hang them all with my question and run through the argument and then see what the whether you have a good answer to it. The improved version of this, what we say to them is, look, you've got, I make it a 10% chance of being executed, but you can buy off the fine for your offense, which we're not charging you because you can't pay us $100,000. Pay us $10,000 and we'll take it from 10% down to 9%, 20,000 to 8%. So that way we're going to use as much fine as you can pay and then fill in the rest with probabilistic execution.
Does the probability, does that include like future crimes? Like,
what do you
mean? Propensity to commit crimes?
I'm ignoring, as before, somewhere in here, as I say, I'm ignoring incapacitation. And obviously, incapacitation is complicated because on the one hand, hanging somebody permanently incapacitates them. On the other hand, you would be hanging one person instead of imprisoning, say, six people. So you might get more incapacitation for the imprisonment. You'd have to know on what the trade-offs were, as it were. So I'm just ignoring incapacitation. And then the question is there a good reason? Take my improved version, actually, with the fine, because my argument works better for that, as it turns out. Is there a good reason why we don't want to switch to the system?
Paying them is less expensive than
imprisoning him. Yep.
And aren't we more likely to, we're going to hang more people?
Well, this proposal, you're hanging fewer people. You might be right.
Hang more people and it'd be efficient to hang because of how cheap and easy it is to hang.
Let me go on to my more extended version. Should say it's the second proposal that I was actually making when somebody offered the argument that led me to the line of argument that I'm going to be giving here to what's wrong with it. All right. But I think you're going in the right direction. So let me tell you the set of stories which it seems to me suggests why efficient punishments might not be such a good thing. And the first is a story, any of you ever read H.L. Mencken? H.L. Mencken? Your loss. He was a journalist and essayist in the first half of the 20th century. Walter Lippmann, who you may have heard of, once called him the most powerful man in America, because in about the 1920s, if you were sort of an educated young adult, Mencken was the person you read and told people that you read to show how up with it you were, as it were. He's very good. He's a very, he was sort of a cynical, very intelligent author. But one of the story, one, he tells the following anecdote, that there's a sheriff in some rural area who likes his jail to be in good condition. So once a year, he calls in his deputies and says, "All right, go out to the bars tonight. I want one carpenter, one plumber, and one painter." And the deputies go out to the bars, and somebody in a bar is always doing something you can claim is disturbing the peace or whatever. And so they arrest one painter, one plumber, and one carpenter. They put him in the jail for 3 or 4 days, during which they fix up the jail, and then they let them go. All right. The version that I originally came across was actually an online argument when I was suggesting the idea of working off all, of having everything be fine so you then worked off in the sort of private prison version I gave. And the person I was talking with said, "Well, you know, the colonial powers in Africa did that. When they wanted a road built, they would find some excuse to arrest a whole lot of the natives, and then their punishment would be working for a certain length of time building the road." And Larry, any of you science fiction readers? What? That's the problem. The problem is the basic problem I'm raising, and if you think about many different legal systems, one of the sort of threads that runs through at least my attempts to make sense of different legal systems is how do you give people an incentive to punish those who commit offenses, but not too much incentive. Because incentive means you benefit by doing it. If you benefit by doing it, you know, you do it whether they're guilty or not. Larry Niven. Any of you read Larry Niven, science fiction author? Yeah. You've read
stuff,
among other things. This is a different series. He has a series of stories which start in our near future when somebody points out how wasteful it is to execute people and just let their bodies rot when there's a shortage of organs. And so in his near future story, one country after another passes the perfectly obviously efficient law, efficient, humanitarian, good and always law, which is if you're going to execute anybody, someone anyway, his organs will all forfeit for transplant. So not only does he die, but he saves somebody else's life. It's a wonderful thing. Then what happens? There still aren't enough organs. There's still a shortage of organs. You might die because there aren't enough organs. Just, how soft do you feel on criminals? You see the, what?
Not at all.
You see, the logic of the situation is that there's now political pressure to expand the range of capital offenses in order to get more organs. And in Niven's short story, which I think is the one that first introduces this idea, the protagonist of the story is sitting in jail awaiting execution. And you discover at the end that the crime he's being executed for is having for a third time driven in such a way as to endanger human life. So three dangerous driving convictions, we don't know what dangerous driving is, that become a capital offense. So that is, I should say, Niven wrote the story long before I published my Journal of Political Economy article making the same arguments. So he's a clever guy. And of course, another important example in our society is civil forfeiture. That there was actually a story in California some years ago where police came on the property of somebody moderately wealthy who owned some valuable land, and he came down the stairs, I think in his pajamas, and they shot him dead. And the police were not even police from the jurisdiction he was in, they were from the neighboring jurisdiction, and they claimed they were looking for marijuana. And it turned out that one of the things they had done before the raid was to investigate the value of his property. Because under civil forfeiture law, if he was growing marijuana on the property, they could claim forfeiture and get the property. And there's some work by Bruce Benson, who's a law professor in Florida. And his account of the sequence of events is that state civil forfeiture statutes frequently provide that what forfeits to some branch of government very distant from the police department. So it goes into the education fund or something, which is a very sensible thing to do if you don't want police incentives to be affected by forfeiture. That at some point, federal law was changed in such a way that a federal law enforcement agency could adopt a forfeiture done by a state or local agency and then share the proceeds with the state or local agency. And the result of that was a big shift of resources into the war on drugs, because the war on drugs was an opportunity where there were lots of money going around that you could forfeit. And now there was an incentive to do it. Now, let's go back. And I was reminded at this point, a number of years ago, I got a phone call from somebody who asked me if I would be interested in speaking at a conference on money laundering. And I said, well, he identified himself, by the way, as a forensic accountant, which I thought was a sort of a neat job description. And I said, well, you know, you do realize that I'm in favor of money laundering. And he said, yes. And so I went and gave a talk I don't remember anymore on, but I also attended the conference. And there was one series of talks about a particular operation against money laundering, which, if I remember correctly, brought in something like $100 million. So that's obviously going to have large effects on the incentives of police as to what they investigate if it's too profitable. So the argument I'm suggesting, I want to claim indeed that one might view the widespread prejudice against cannibalism as a social norm designed to discourage rent-seeking. The Man-Eating Myth, by the way, is a rather fun book by an anthropologist who decided to investigate the anthropological evidence for cannibalism. And every anthropologist he asked about evidence said, oh, that other anthropologist can tell you about a real example of cannibalism. And his conclusion, which may have been slightly exaggerated, but probably not very much, is that almost all of the anthropological accounts of cannibalism come from people in Tribe A telling the anthropologist, those people in Tribe B, they're so terrible, they even eat human beings. Anyway, but my argument is that if there were no norm against cannibalism in poor societies where people are hungry, there is then a sizable profit to killing people, which would then raise, obviously, rent-seeking problems. Similarly, consider the organ transplant issue, that the perfectly obvious, to me, way of solving the shortage of organs for transplant is to have an ordinary market in organs, and then presumably most of that would be people saying, I agree that if I die, my organs can be transplanted, and their value will then go to my heirs. Or it could be, I will sell you now. You pay me $1,000 now, and I agree that when I die, you can arrange for the transplant of my organs and collect whatever money they collect. Some of it, kidneys, you've got two kidneys, you only need one, so there would presumably be some market of living people selling kidneys. And there, it's illegal. Treating it as a market is illegal in the U.S., like everywhere, I think. But the one obvious problem with it is, again, the rent-seeking problem, that, you know, so you're worth $50,000 on the hoof, you might disappear. And you might be able to solve that by requiring good chain of title for organs. That would be the obvious way of trying to do it. but a straight open market clearly raises some real problems. And in fact, there have been stories, whether correct, I don't know, suggesting that people in China are being executed for the purpose of getting their organs to sell them on the, I guess, black market, or I don't know quite how it's being organized.
So, is there an inefficiency in executing someone?
There's an inefficiency in my killing you for $50,000 worth of organs when your value to yourself on the hoof is $1 million. And preventing that inefficiency would then involve various costs. All right. So
okay.
There's no inefficiency from the economic standpoint if you decide to sell a kidney, because you would rather have $10,000 than a spare kidney.
It's like in the case of a heart, like we just take some sort of a closed population. If this guy doesn't get a heart, then he's going to die. His value to getting a heart is probably the same as my value of living.
Well, except that your heart is much better for you than for him. Heart transplant's a difficult and tricky operation.
Assuming that you could have perfect technology.
But then what happens then is that on a market, you still won't sell your heart, or hardly anybody will, because there's no way of paying you.
Right, but if somebody killed you,
then the that gets into the problems that I discussed in Value of Life a long time ago. And if we're willing to accept your value of life at 1,000 times your value of one chance in 1,000 of dying, then killing you for the transplant might be an efficient transaction. On the other hand, we'd have to worry about all of the costs people would spend defending themselves against that and hunting other people and so forth. There's a problem with doing that, which is in general the reason why what we think of as criminal activities are usually not a very good way of allocating resources. But what I would actually expect to get would be that the hearts would not be coming from people who were alive, but people who had just died and had made arrangements in advance to sell the heart, either for their heirs or for themselves. So I'm not sure what we'll do Thursday, but I'm sure we'll find something. Maybe we'll even get ahead of our schedule. I think we've had the whole week for criminal. We just finished my outline on it. But I will think if I want to say more things about it. You may think if there is stuff here that you'd like to go over again. And in the worst case, I'll start on whatever we're doing next. Oh, consider one point, which I think I make in the book. And that is, what makes rape a particularly serious criminal problem? And one answer is it's the same as the cannibalism problem, that you have lots of resources, but we don't worry about people stealing them because most of them aren't where they can be stolen, right? If I carried my net worth in my wallet, the problem of preventing people from mugging me would be a whole lot bigger than it is, because my net worth is probably thousands of times the amount of money I normally carry. The problem with rape is that there is a benefit to the rapist, and that the victim can't lock up the property that he's trying to steal. Just as in the case of organ transplant with an open market, you can't lock up your body. And just as the cannibalism case. So those are all cases which sort of raise the issue that you would like to have things arranged so the things people want to steal are things that it's easy to keep them from stealing. And if the thing is yourself, or parts of your body, or the use of your body, same thing would be true with regard to slavery. That if you had a system where slavery was legal, and where there wasn't an easy way of showing where a slave came from, then we would all have to worry about being kidnapped as slaves, sort of, you know, at the next opportunity, as it were. Anyway, see you Thursday. With luck, my voice will last through one more class.